Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast, everyone. I am Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal magazine, and that is John Rauhouse playing in the background as always. There is a massive snowstorm supposedly coming to Seattle, so we are all hunkered down, but I wanted to get this podcast out the door before we get snowed in with all of 6 inches of snow. Today on the podcast, I'm talking to musician Kevin Odegaard, who is a great singer-songwriter with a fascinating backstory. Back in 1974, Bob Dylan's crew tapped him to play on at least part of the Blood on the Tracks sessions, and it is Kevin's guitar, it's Kevin's playing, it's his 1969 Martin D28 that you hear on Tangled Up in Blue. The rest is history. And fast forward 44, 45 years, Kevin is now actually selling that Martin D28 through our friends over at Dream Guitars. So if anybody wants a piece of rock and roll and music history, head on over to Dream Guitars and you can read all about it. But I just wanted mainly to get Kevin's story. It's a good one, and I think you guys will dig it. Speaking of good stories, the Fretboard Journal 43 is full of them. And if you haven't subscribed yet, now is the time to do so. You can do so over at fretboardjournal.com. Use the coupon code PODCAST. I will take $5 off your order. In that issue, Billy Strings, Molly Tuttle, Rory Hoffman, George Loudon, and a lot more. A lot of our readers are saying it is their favorite issue we've put out to date, and I would love to send it your way. And so all new subscriptions for the next week or so are going to start with that issue, if you want it, at no extra cost. So go to fretboardjournal.com, do that. If you are in the mood for more podcasts, maybe you are also snowed in. We just posted the latest episode of The Truth About Vintage Amps with Skip Simmons. We are up to 4 volumes of that, and we are having a blast doing it. So if anybody is at all remotely interested in the world of guitar amplification, check out that podcast and send us questions. Questions are really what fuels that. That's what when I get about 10 pages in my Google Doc of questions for Skip, I give him a call, which right now is about every 2 weeks. So that's how we do that podcast. Lots of other stuff going on. We've got NAMM photos up on our website as well, some of the highlights that we saw, and a lot more. So including a bench press column with Ed Claxton that everyone should check out. So those are all the updates from almost snowy Seattle. Hope everyone is well and warm. And this is my conversation with Kevin Odegaard. Kevin, I have all sorts of questions for you. I want to talk to you about this Martin D28 that's for sale. But before we get to all that, for folks who may not know who you are, tell me a little bit about yourself.
I'm an overgrown folkie from Minnesota who's not a terrific guitar player. Never thought much of my own guitar playing until 30 years after I recorded with Bob Dylan on Blood on the Tracks. And once I heard Steve Berkowitz isolated track mixes, I realized I'd had a good day back there in December of 1974. So I rather liked what I had done. There was a lot of interplay between me and Bob, and so I gained a new respect for my playing and picked up again and started a Dylan tribute band called Blood on the Tracks Live. And for the next decade, up until just very recently, have been doing just that with the same guitar that I used back in 1974, the Martin D28. And that's really who I am. I've had, being a musician is, to quote Michael McDonald, an expensive hobby. And if Michael McDonald is saying that, it's got to be true. And it is, and I found it to be true. So I've worked in the music industry as an advocate for songwriters' rights and earnings at the National Academy of Songwriters. Before the Dylan sessions, I was a brakeman on the Chicago Northwestern Railroad for 4 years. I faked sick to go to the sessions for Bob Dylan, because his brother needed me. I dodged calls from the crew caller so that I could get there, and I was home watching Kochak one night when I got that call.
All right. Well, listen, we got to slow down because this story is we can't rush over this. So you grew up in Minnesota.
Yep, grew up in small town Minnesota on Highway 168.
Okay.
The road that you take to go to Hibbing, Minnesota, from Minneapolis.
Go ahead.
Yeah, we're halfway to Hibbing from Minneapolis.
Okay. And you're playing guitar, you're playing folk music, and you become a brakeman, not necessarily a singing brakeman, because you needed a job or you didn't want to go to college, or what was that? What was the story there?
I'd already been to college, and really just decided at one point to drop out and run away to New York and hitchhike with my girlfriend to Greenwich Village and become a folk singer, like others before me. So I'm really no different than any other kid from small town Minnesota. In that I had dreams, and I kind of dropped everything to make them come true. When I did get back and started playing gigs in Minneapolis, I had a record contract and played in bands for years, but found, just as I have in recent years and all throughout my life, that playing music for me and for many others I respect and admire is an expensive hobby. So I work day jobs. I've always worked day jobs on the railroad, for nonprofits, for Apple, I've worked a bunch of different things that have kept me going and kept the music playing and helped me support playing in a band and having fun with it.
And before that fateful call, when you were making your own music, how big of an impact did Dylan have on you, or were you influenced by some of the other folkies out there?
I was influenced by the Greenwich folk scene, beginning with a record called Washington Square by the Village Stompers. It was the first record I ever bought. It was on Epic Records. And I was very young, early 60s. And I liked that. I liked the Kingston Trio, the Limelighters, the Chad Mitchell Trio. Hootenanny was my favorite television show. Dyed in the Wool folkie, still on today. Loved to hear that sound of what I later identified was the unique sound. And your readers are going to disagree with me on this. But I'm a Martin junkie. I can spot the sound of a Martin from 40 paces. I could pick it out of it. Of a grouping of guitars. I'll tell you which one the Martin is.
Sure.
So I am just always, I've always been in love with the sound of a Martin. I was given a ukulele at Boy Scout camp, Cub Scout camp, in 1965. And on July 25th of that year, I heard Bob Dylan on my little contraband transistor radio. Held up to my ears, singing this angry rant called Like a Rolling Stone. And my life was never the same after July 25th, 1965. I pledged myself to the craft and the devotion at that point, and I've never let up, never let it go, never dropped it. So it was really weird when I hooked up with David Zimmerman a few years later, actually right after I dropped out of college. I had a record contract, so David became my manager.
Okay.
After my short time at Greenwich Village. And so I had a relationship with the family. We lined up at various family events together, and I'd met Bob. I worked for Bob. Worked for David. I recorded a demo of a song called Nobody Except You that Bob had written for Planet Waves. He didn't want it bootlegged, so he hired me and sent it to Johnny Rodriguez. And I sang at a wedding for his cousins at summer camp that summer of 74. So my auditions were a wedding and a demo that I'd done. And I guess I somehow, I was really nervous. I mean, at the wedding, I sang another brand new song. Just hot off the presses, called Forever Young. And I'm 5 feet behind Bob and Louis Kemp. And they're facing away from me, facing the Bema, and I'm behind them, shaking like a leaf. I think I brought a brown paper bag with me that day to hyperventilate. It was a very nerve-wracking experience singing. I was just learning the song, and I was flattered to be hired, but wow, what pressure. I mean, a family event, and there he is. It was terrifying. I don't think I ever recovered from that.
and they asked you to play Forever Young? Was that the deal?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Bob wanted that. Bob chose that song because Neil and Linda, the bride and groom, had gone over some stuff with Bob, and Bob wanted to help, and Bob is a family guy. He's a mensch. He's very close and generous with his family and others, very quietly generous in the community, and in all respects, from what I know in the last 50 years, just a wonderful human being. So I couldn't do enough. They paid me $50, and I showed up. And it was great. And the phone rang, 6 months later. It was strike three for me. It was incredible. I didn't believe my luck. David somehow trusted me, and I helped him find musicians. He found the rhythm section. I found a couple of the other guys, and things just took off. The find that I didn't intend to find was Chris Weber, who owned a Podium guitar shop in Minneapolis, which was in those days famous. It was in Dinkytown and specialized in Martins. David was asking me for a guitar, a particular guitar, a 0042 of 1937 vintage. Did I have one? Did I know somebody that had one? Could I look for one? And of course the answer is yes. So I called Chris right away, and he said, "Have you been in my shop?" I said, "Of course I've been in your shop. You see me every day in your shop. Because I've got one right on the wall right behind me right now. You must have been snooping in here. And what's it for anyway?" Right away he smelled blood. He was suspicious. And we still have this kind of faux adversarial relationship to this day. He really scouted his way onto that session and wound up being the guy. He had to accompany this guitar because it was on consignment. It was a 0042. It wasn't a 37. It was a little bit later vintage. But it was good enough for Bob, known as the Joan Baez guitar.
Yeah.
The guitar you hear on Lily Rosemary and the Jack of Hearts and Tangled Up and so. And Bob scratched it up so badly at the sessions that Chris insisted on selling it to him. But when Chris got there, his role quickly became to work with Bob. They had a nice rapport going. Chris's Guild 12 string is heard prominently on Tangled Up and Blue. Chris would learn the songs, and the vocal book would come out and teach them to the rest of the band. So we had a real crispy Midwestern string sound on that record. Everything is in tune. With our five songs on Tangled Up in Blue, which you cannot say about every other Bob Dylan album, we are in tune. That's one of the things we're proud of. It's one of the things we're proudest of.
It's that down-to-earth Midwestern sensibility.
we were. But then we had two jazz cats, David's picks, were Billy Berg and Billy Peterson. Bill Berg on the stand-up bass, and he brought a Fender precision bass. They were improvisers. Their previous work was with Leo Kottke, another wonder Wonder kind on guitar, you know, and they just finished Dreams and all that stuff, which to my mind is Leo Kottke's Blood on the Tracks. It's his masterpiece. Mm-hmm. And Leo Kottke never in his life played the same song twice in the same way. So these guys are on the fly. They're the guys that you want. They're the studio guys that you want. Very highly educated, reading. They read music, which is incredible. They're, you know, they can read charts. I mean, acts like the Righteous Brothers would come through town, and the guys they pick up would be, you know, Billy Peterson and his friends. So they were experienced by that point. And once they got over the surprise, the shock of actually seeing Bob in the studio on the 27th of December, everybody relaxed. Because Bob realized that Bill Berg was from his hometown of Hibbing. And now everything got very relaxed. And while no photographs were allowed, Berg later painted two watercolor and pencil, watercolor and pen, I think, drawings, which I just donated yesterday to the Bob Dylan Center in Tulsa. Wow. So, very talented, multi-talented people who expressed themselves in and outside of music. Berg went on to become a very famous animator with Walt Disney. He is the Beast in Beauty and the Beast. His very first film was All Dogs Go to Heaven. He did 19 big hit films for Disney and did very well in his life. And now what does Bill Berg do? He does whatever he wants. He has homes in North Carolina and in San Diego. He plays with his jazz trio, the Wayne Johnson Trio. Billy Peterson is still playing out there. He spent 25 years with Steve Miller Band. And Chris Weber is retired, living in California, and still repairs and sets up guitars, mostly Martins. We're all in love with Martins. I fell in love with Martins at summer camp, and then I went to a summer stock show in a place called Medora, North Dakota, where Stephen DeLapp and Chuck Anderson with the other guitar players, and of course they had Martin D28s, and I was, at that point it was all over. There was no other guitar on planet Earth for me. Nothing sounds like that guitar to me. Nothing. No homemade guitar, no custom-made guitar. I'm not going to insult custom guitars or anything like that, but all I can say is that nothing sounds as sweet and rich and mellow as a well-played tuned up Martin to my ear, and it remains that way today. It's just, I'm a huge fan. Got to tour the factory a couple of years ago, and where they refurbished my original Martin, and it sounds as good as it did the day it came home from Manny's Music Store in New York City. It's rich, powerful, and emotional. It has a voice like a human being, to my mind.
I was going to ask, how long before these Blood on the Tracks sessions did you have that Martin D28? And I'm curious also, when you got the call for the session, were there any other Martins in your quiver you thought about taking?
Any other
Martin guitars that you owned?
No, because what I played in Medora, North Dakota in summer stock was an Epiphone 12-string.
Okay.
Which quickly became a toy when my Martin came home. I mean, I would use it occasionally. My other great love became, for other reasons, the Rickenbacker Electric 12-string. So those are my two guitars, which I still have. The Rickenbacker, signed by Roger McGuinn, who taught me how to play it in nice. L.A. when we were both working there together on behalf of songwriters. But that's another story. It's a funny story because my grandfather flew in World War I with Eddie Rickenbacker, whose poor cousin Adolf invented the electronic 12-string mm-hmm. guitar. So 6 degrees of separation. My grandfather's violin sits in the Air Force Museum, signed by every member of the squadron, Eddie Rickenbacker's squadron, who fought the Red Baron over Belgium and France in World War I. So there's some history there. And my Martin may someday sit at the Bob Dylan Center. It has a provenance which I think is unequaled. The other guitars at the session are not in as good a shape as my Martin. Let's say the Joan Baez guitar, the small body 0042, went to one of Bob's friends. And the last time I saw it was at a concert in about 73, 74. And it had holes all over it, and it was beaten up. And it was just something that Bob handed off to one of his pals just to be generous and to give something away. And so as far as I know, this is the only guitar from any of the sessions, New York or Minneapolis, for Blood on the Tracks, and more recently, More Blood, More Tracks on Columbia Records.
Mm-hmm.
That is still alive today. And this is the one. It's the only one left. And it, to me, if I could play it, I would keep it. But I'm aging. Arthritis took it over my left hand. I can't really thumb wrap anymore, for which I have to thank John Prine. Thank you very much. So I think it needs to find such a rich, wonderful instrument. I think it benefit from finding somebody who loves to play it, loves to look at it. It's good for both.
Yeah, and I got to go back to the sessions when these were happening. Did you know the backstory? Did you know that there were some New York sessions? And also, did you know? You know, was it immediate just how powerful this album was going to be?
Not until the 6 minutes of Tangled Up in Blue ended in silence, all of us looking at her shoes. No, not until that moment. David had told me on the phone, well, Bob wants to do one song. Can you get some guys? And I wound up recommending Greg Inhofer. And you heard the story about how Chris Webber invited himself along and became part of history. It was very, very helpful part of those sessions. The thing went so well because in New York, if you've seen anything about the two sessions, and there have been more pieces lately than before, New York was acrimonious. Nobody going along with anybody. Everybody was kind of angry. Bob wasn't getting what he wanted. And in my opinion, Phil Ramone turned the echo up way too high, which didn't sound good, especially with Bob's coat buttons bumping on the front of the guitar. So that was a mess. And when he got to Minneapolis, he was with his family. He was in a completely different headspace. Very, very happy and mellow, being with his kids. He brought one or two of his kids to the sessions. And he felt, I mean, it felt like all of us, like we were just in a garage band again. There was no nervousness at all at that point. I mean, yes, I was nervous at the wedding. Yes, I was nervous during doing the demo. But by the halfway through the sessions, by the time I got my chance on Monday, the 30th of December, to play on Tangled Up in Blue, I forgot who I was to such an extent that I told Bob that we should change the key of the song, and I forgot I was with, you know, the poet laureate. I forgot that I was with this rock star, and I just blurted out, well, it's all right, but why don't we move it up to A?
Mm-hmm.
It would have a little bit more zip. It would have, you know, it has, G to me is a folk idiom. It has a voice of Appalachia. It has a, it goes back to really more folk than rockabilly. When you bump up to A, the A voice to me adds that edge. I can always, I don't have perfect pitch, but I know an A chord.
Sure.
I know when something's in A. I have only perfect pitch in the key of A. It's like I can only speak Mexican on a Mexican fishing boat in Mexico. But the perfect pitch thing is, no, I don't have it. But A was always my favorite key because it cuts like a knife. G is mellow, and you can tell a story. And I was riding on the Mayflower when I thought I spotted some red. You know, and Dylan did a lot of stuff like that. He had written the entire album, Blood on the Tracks, in open E tuning, which got him kicked out of Mike Bloomfield's house in San Rafael when he was touring the country playing these songs for friends. And it was so monotonous, so tiresome. The entire album in open tuning E that the few of his friends who dared to told him the truth. And he didn't like what he heard, but by the time it got to Minneapolis, it was in G. I'd heard previously that it had been in D. and I bumped it up to A, and right away we played maybe three measures. Right away he stopped, and he turned to Paul Martinson, our engineer, and he said, yeah, okay, well, let's take that. And I came up with a little lick I learned on a record by a group called Joy of Cooking out of the Bay Area. Diddle-doom-doom, I was finger picking. And again, I didn't hear it for 30 years until Steve Berkowitz isolated it. Hey, that's good, you know. But you can hear it now. And I first heard it in the new mix when we were sitting in with one of Dylan's people in New York City, my wife and I, and bang, right off the top, there's the Martin there, and I'm finger picking it, no steel finger picks, nothing, just with my fingers. And about the fifth verse, you can hear Bob do the upswing or the upstrum and me do the downstrum. We're that much in tune. There's a lot of eye contact going on. Everybody's really kind of grooving on this song. And Bill Berg is playing at the very tail end of the beat with his brushes on the snare. So he creates this vacuum effect, which I just called the groove of the thing. But by the time it was over, it was one take. We did do a take, which has since been lost, in the key of G. But when archivists and historians and authors interview me, they always say, gee, if we could only recover the lost grail, the version in G. I tell them, nope, you're not missing anything. It wasn't that good. It really wasn't. This one's better.
What was Bob playing guitar-wise?
Bob was on he was on that little guitar, the Joan Baez guitar. And actually, that's the guitar Untangled. Yeah, you can hear it. He's hitting it a little harder there than he does. He's more of a thumb strum on Lily Rosemary, but he's hitting it with his nails on Tangled, and you can hear it. He didn't do any capos. He didn't do anything. He just changed position and went for it. Master musician at that point in his life had been through, and I've just found this out recently because even yesterday reviewing some of the files and paperwork at the Bob Dylan Center at Tulsa, a slavish amount of work into these songs between September and December when we saw it. Just an enormous amount of work, which you can hear, you know, on More Blood, More Tracks. You can hear the genesis of the whole thing. But by the time he got to Minneapolis, it was a completely different version of Bob Dylan that we got, and he's very relaxed with his homeboys. It was like he was with a bunch of guys from the neighborhood, and it was the same for us. Nobody was in, you know, so I guess I forgot where I was, but the result was good, and I think, what I joke about with my wife who's driving the car right now is every time we go through the Atlanta airport, we hear that one on the escalator. <Diddle-dum-dum. laughs> And so it's stood up. It has stood up over time. They didn't really organically change the mix that much. What Steve Adabo did, who is a master mixer, is he unproduced it. He took all the effects out from the original release in 1975. And it sounds better, cleaner. You can hear the richness of those tremendous instruments, the Guilds and the Martins and Billy's stand-up bass and Bill Berg's sonor drums, acoustically wonderfully balanced, playing together in a room. Bob never used headphones, so it's a live performance. Most of what you hear on there is, and much of what you hear that was overdubbed was not us, it was Bob. Bob overdubbed a flamenco guitar part on If You See Her Say Hello. He overdubbed mandolin. He borrowed Peter Ostrusko's mandolin. Peter's is on there too, and especially in this new mix, it's gorgeous. The low part that Peter played originally wasn't feeling well enough to play the high part Bob heard in his head during the sessions. But both parts are clearly heard now in this new mix, and it's just rich and wide and wonderful sound. The Hammond B3 organ, nice, great big grand piano. Bob overdubbed the B3 organ on Idiot Wind. Mm-hmm. There were many takes, maybe 8 of Idiot Wind, again, all of which were lost, and all of which I again say to historians and musicologists, nope. Just listen to this one. This is the one, you know. I was there, you know. That was the one that was head and shoulders above the rest. I also agree with their editorial decision to keep all of the takes and follow Bob's transition, you know, from what was intended to be just another acoustic album. He wanted to make Freewheeling again into what it evolved into. And it, within 20 days, became his fastest and best-selling album ever on Columbia Records. Remains that way today. But we've been described in various different ways, and again, critics differ greatly on this. Oh, the New York sessions are better than the Minneapolis sessions. The Minneapolis guys are colorless. I don't think so. I think there's a lot of fire in Idiot Wind. I think there's a lot of emotion entangled up in Blue. There certainly was in the room, and it was a live performance that left us all spellbound to the point where there was no talking for a good 45 seconds, maybe a minute afterwards. We looked at our shoes. we took a breath. And to answer your question directly, that was the moment. That was the moment that my grandchildren came to mind. And my grandson had just been born in the last year. And in history, this is the one that he will hear. We knew something permanent had happened. We knew something very, the word masterpiece wasn't used for 20 or 30 years on Blood on the Tracks, but it certainly is one of his masterpieces. I like a lot of his stuff. My favorite Dylan album happens to be Blonde on Blonde.
Sure.
But Tangled Up in Blue is one for the ages, and it hasn't changed enough from the original released version to even comment, although it's been sonically improved thanks to Steve Adavo bringing out those rich guitar strings and de-echoing the thing. It took all the, because, you know, you're recording acoustic instruments, effects are different in 1974 than they are in 2018. They're very different. They begin to sound dated. And if you take them out, you're ahead of the game, because now 50 years from now, they'll still sound great. People can do what they want with them at home now with all the gadgets that are available. All the software that's available, you can mix your own Bob Dylan record.
Sure.
But it's a great thing that in my lifetime, I waited 44 years for this to happen, and didn't talk much about it in the interim until I heard the Steve Berkowitz mixes. I worked in Hollywood for decades and really never floated that idea too much, because there were no credits. My name wasn't on the album. Who would believe me? who was going to believe this? And so I just let it rest for decades, long time.
Yeah,
it came back around.
It's known for being one of the most powerful, not only the most powerful records of all time, but one of the most powerful breakup albums. But it sounds like the mood in the studio was actually pretty laid back, even with Bob.
Hard for me to give you a snapshot of that, because Bob, as friendly and engaging as he was in that studio, had spent 6 months torturing himself. Mm-hmm. We saw pages and pages, dozens of pages on each song, the lyrics we've never heard, lyrics that didn't make it to the final cut. Dozens and dozens of pages, iterations, obviously slavish work over 6 months to get to where he was in Minneapolis. So he was ready finally to do what he did in Minneapolis, very focused, probably heartbroken, not going to confide in people he's seeing for the first time ever in his life, but his brother certainly knew. We felt it through the music. You know, we got choked up. There were some times, Idiot Wind and Tangled Up in Blue will put a lump in your throat. And you can imagine what they did in real time in the studio. Very powerful stuff. Very powerful. And we all wandered off into the very cold December night, 2 feet off the ground, back to our lives, back to our jobs, back to our day jobs, nightclub jobs. Wondering if anything would ever come of any of this. We didn't know. Could get thrown out just like the New York stuff did. We had no idea.
Yeah. When all was said and done, how many days were you in the studio for these sessions, and how many songs did you end up appearing on?
I'm on one. I'm in Tangled Up in Blue. We were in for 2 days, the 27th and the 30th, for a period of about 3 hours each.
Okay.
I witnessed the first day and helped contract the musicians. And then, because I'd done that, David Zimmerman, I guess Greg Inhofer, reminded him that, hey, give Kevin a shot at this, because he got me the gig. So I got called up on the first song, which just for no reason whatsoever was Tangled Up in Blue. And it was in G, and I didn't like it. I said so. So that's I just thought it wasn't that special. It wasn't that didn't stand out, and needed a key change. It needed to go from that traditional folk key, the one that came over the big pond, to more of a more of that southern folk blues tradition from Mississippi. And that's where A and E come into my way of thinking. They're all different languages. Every key, even on an acoustic, especially on an acoustic guitar, brings a different region to my mind. And we went from Appalachia to Mississippi and changing that key from G to A. We went straight over to Mississippi.
That's a good way to put it.
Yep, and I think it worked in spite of the fact that I knew nothing about music and I wasn't that great of a guitar player. That was my best performance ever. It's so odd that I didn't hear it for 30 years because it was kind of, it melted into the mix, but I'd never played that well before, and I've never played that well since. I can't even recreate that part now. I mean. So, you know, no, Leo Kottke, I'm not.
No, it's all right. How much do you get paid for being on one of the greatest songs of all time?
$325.
Okay. I don't know what your brakeman job was paying, but yeah, of course. There were some benefits to this.
But Fretboard Journal is a terrific magazine that I associate with the craft and, you know, the art of playing and the craft of, you know, the luthier and the whole beauty of this idiom. And it's where my head has been since the Medora musical and Camp Ajawa and all that stuff. 'Cause we had Martin Yukes up at the camp. And that was back when they made baritones. I don't think they do anymore. They made tenors.
Yeah.
But I've always worshipped that Martin brand and never was swayed by anything else. Yeah, this is my custom. It cost $30,000 and it was with James Taylor for 4 years. Yeah, I'll just put it back in the case. Thank you. You know, I'm not interested. There's nothing that rings my bell like a Martin. It's not even close. It doesn't even get my attention.
Yeah, you're not alone with that sentiment. So the 69 D28, the Dylan Sessions end, that's just your guitar. You're playing it for decades.
Yeah. And I could never play anything after that. It's like, you know, how could you get anything that sounds better than the thing that when you pick it up, it just connects directly with your heart and makes your whole body sing every note you play. I mean, you just bump the strings when you're tuning up and it sounds great. it's as good as any medical healing instrument. You put it in your gut and you feel better already. My charity that I've worked with so many years is all about helping veterans with PTSD get off drugs and get the guitar singing in their gut to put them back in rhythm because they've been through a terrible thing.
Mm-hmm.
The guitar is a healing instrument. It's a medical miracle to me because this whole foundation, this charity, Guitars for Vets out of Milwaukee, is based on a guitar in your gut. That's the secret of healing. That's the secret of making yourself feel good. You take 6 lessons from these guys, and they give you a guitar. You know, music therapy. It's a miracle to me, and it's just my opinion.
No, it makes perfect sense. How has this guitar, which is now 50 years old, fared over the years? Did you say at one point the guys in Nazareth restored it?
I took it to Nazareth, and they fixed some cracks, and they did this and that because, you know, I bounced it around a little in my life. But it still looks great. It doesn't look like Willie Nelson's guitar. Let's put it that way. It
sure
doesn't have a hole in it. Hang on 1 second. I I'm back.
All right, you're back.
Yeah, starting to plan lunch. It looks great. It sounds, I would say, as good or better, you know, as it did when I got it. But Martin went over the whole thing. It took 6 months and pronounced it perfect. And I mean, I can't even throw the thing out of tune anymore. they do such good work there. Even, I mean, today we were so impressed. We wanted to stay all day. We got a nice tour, and the guide complimented. I took the guitar out and showed it, and complimented, and told me what he thought it might be worth. But, you know, none of that really mattered because I was still in one piece at that point. I can no longer play the thing now, so mm-hmm. I'd rather that it find a good home for some you know, for somebody who can enjoy the sound of it.
Yeah.
But you know, at that point, it was like getting the Good Housekeeping seal of approval from Martin. I felt like they really loved it, and they paid a lot of attention to it. It got, you know, it got passed around some of the folks at the factory there, and we heard a lot of great things about that guitar. And it's got a personality and a lifespan that no other guitar really has.
For sure, and some
especially
stories,
especially in regard to Blood on the Tracks.
It's a cult
record. You know, it's not the biggest selling record by anybody ever. It's not like a, you know, Stairway, or it's not like, what is the biggest selling record? Thriller? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't even know these days.
No, either do I. But it's Bob's best selling studio album. Always has been, always will be. Desire is up there too. But those are the days when records sold more.
Yeah.
Units, you know, and they were vinyl. You know, he did great work later in his career. Time Out of Mind, wonderful record. Some great stuff later on. But this one went like triple platinum or something. I lost track many, many decades ago.
Did you ever cross paths with him after the sessions?
Certainly, yeah. Ran into him here and there. Ran into him in Hollywood from time to time. Went to an ASCAP awards dinner where I thanked him for what had become by that time a career, because by then I was representing songwriters' rights and earnings for the National Academy of Songwriters. I was fighting the good fight for revenue, for source licensing and things that would come along. Digital wasn't a thing when I started out in music, or when he started out in music, and movie licensing, television licensing, even ad licensing was in its infancy. So it needed advocacy. Somebody had to be standing up, not just for the writer's penny on music publishing, but for, I mean, it's still, the United States lags behind Europe. I get mechanical royalties for playing on Blood on the Tracks, but not from the United States.
Sure.
I get international mechanicals. And the United States is in, you know, hasn't evolved or doesn't have the attitude about creativity that the rest of the world does have, and in fact is law around the planet, out, you know, outside of the U.S. So we're Neanderthals when it comes to copyright.
Kind of, yeah.
We are. So,
how hard was it for you to go back to work as a brakeman after those sessions, or did you just give your notice immediately?
I've been asking everybody on Facebook, because I kept all those railroad friends. Well, did you believe me? Because I tell a story, you know, on a caboose. I tell the, hey, Ed. So I just played on this Bob Dylan record. And they come back, and you can see it, actually. It's still in my, if you go to my Facebook page, you can see some of the conversations. Yeah, I always believed you. It was me who didn't believe in myself. It was me who, after so many years of no credits and no thought to it and doing other things and getting redirected and distracted by new projects, it was me who put it on the back seat and stopped believing it. There were times, we all have hard times in our life, there were times when I wondered if I'd made the whole thing up.
Wow.
Yeah, it got that obscure at more than once in my life. It became that it took a back seat to everything else, and it was like, well, now I wonder if it really did happen. It was just part of my creativity. Did I make this thing? Did I make it up? And finally, the powers that be and Dabo and Dylan's management, Columbia Records, Legacy Records, all of a sudden last year, this project came to the fore, and there's my name on the record, and I'm interviewed for the liner notes. And people came out of the woodwork. I heard just as much from people who did not believe me as those who did.
Sure.
So, you know, yeah, I wasn't nuts to shut up about it, but certainly I was facing a lot of people who had doubts about me for many, many years. And for that reason, it was good to have other pursuits and have other things going and always have the day job and in order to be able to play and listen to my art, keep it around and keep it in good shape. The whole project last year was just gave me the freedom to believe in myself as a musician and to let a lot of things go that were perhaps not so positive in my life, you know, to let things go and feel good about myself 100% of the time. That's what it can do for you.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why musicians need credits. I did make this same speech 30, 40 years ago at the National Academy of Songwriters. Credits. What happened when we went from cassettes, and I'm off the subject, but so stop me. But
no, go for it.
When we went from cassettes to CDs, what happened to credits? What happened when we went from vinyl to cassette? When we went from vinyl to cassettes, credits disappeared. We had to meet with all the label heads and say, hey, what happened? If this is a Campbell's soup can, you've got beans in there, right? And that was the speech we made. Put the songwriters on there. It didn't take them much. Then you started seeing flaps. And then the same thing happened with CDs. Where's the credits? Where are they? Who's playing on this thing? The Wrecking Crew went for years making a lot of cash in Hollywood, rarely getting credit for anything they ever did. So they're in worse shape than me.
Yeah.
And they don't care because they did well and they were super, super hot players. Tommy Tedesco and the rest of them. I mean, great people. But no, I could make the same speech. But, you know, without credits, you can lose your musical identity. And that's why it's important for users, end users, producers of television, of video, of all formats, all content, need to recognize, and I'm off the soapbox now, I don't do this anymore, but, you know, they need to recognize who created their hits. We had a show in Hollywood in 84 through 94 called The Salute to the American Songwriter, where we'd have Carol Bayer Sager and Bert Bacharach get up and warble the first few verses of a song that it turned out to be. Then Michael McDonald would come out from backstage and the whole audience would gasp, and this audience was music business audience, because it was on my own, on my own. Oh, I didn't know they wrote that. I thought he wrote that. Mm-hmm. And so there's this whole, you know, gestalt thing going on where we reminded people where, and that was our little trick to entertain and remind them at the same time where music comes from and where, and for players, it's the same thing. I work with people who find my playing, my guitar playing royalties in Europe, in Luxembourg. I get them. So I'm an advocate for that. People need to get paid, appreciated, recognized.
What's so this D28 is now for sale over at our friends at Dream Guitars. What's your hope for it? Who do you hope gets it?
Somebody who plays it.
Yeah.
I'd rather it not sit on the wall. I'm going to say no if it's going to be somebody that's going to put it in a cage or a glass case. I don't have to say yes. I'll just raise the price.
All right. On that
Somebody's
note,
got to play it.
All right. On that note, thank you, Kevin, so much. This was a lot of fun.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.